speaker this year. It's Nick Yangu. I've got three things to say about Nick, and I think that will probably be it for an introduction. Nick works in IT. He has a master's degree in transpersonal psychology, and he is a director of the Library Society of America. So I think he's a modern man. That's what he's saying.
Right.
Hello, welcome. So we've got a slightly different format this year because of a different venue. So Nick is going to give his talk for about 50 minutes. We'll have a quick question session if anyone has a burning passion to interrogate the speaker. We'll have a coffee break, tea break at 3, and then after 3.30, we'll reconvene, and we can take written questions. We've got a little box out the front if any of you are feeling especially shy, or verbal questions, and a pen.
At the back.
So, with no more to say, I'm going to hand this over to the modern man of California.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? Yes, okay, good. Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction. Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Michael. Everyone who was involved in setting this up and so kindly inviting me and flying me out here. And your introduction is more apt in ways than you can imagine. I do really want to talk about a modern perspective. And in fact, a postmodern perspective, and beyond that, an integral perspective. So this is very fitting to be introduced in this way, and I appreciate that very much. I'm also very appreciative of being here as a former student of the Bishara School. So it's a great honor for me to be giving this lecture. As you probably know, the Bishara School stands for a universal perspective, and any perspective that offers a broad, overarching perspective on the meaning of life, on reality, is an education that is worth participating in. So I'm very grateful for that. So this broad universal perspective provides an overarching narrative that invites meaningful engagement with the big questions of life. But meta-narratives in general do not readily find popular acceptance in our academic institutions today. Our intellectual climate is one of deconstruction, reductionism, and postmodern scholars tend to privilege the pluralistic and subjective perspectives over unifying narratives that attempt any holistic or meaningful interpretation of the human experience and the world that we inhabit. However, I believe something is stirring within the culture and taking root in the mainstream of our society. It is these contemporary voices that are the subject of my talk, and it is my aim to attempt, with very broad strokes, an outline of an emerging meta-narrative that embraces a spiritual perspective of evolution, suggesting new ways of thinking about our place in history and what our potential for future evolution might be. Now, this is clearly an immense study, and indeed a subject probably more daunting than I anticipated when I started on this. I think of myself here today really as a journalist reporting on influential contemporary thinkers whose ideas are percolating into the cultural consciousness of our time, and to review their ideas on both the current era and its future potential. Now, by way of a disclaimer, I should probably confess that I currently live in Mill Valley in the Bay Area, which the philosopher Ken Wilber somewhat disparagingly calls the 415 paradigm, referring to the Bay Area telephone area code, and which he calls one of the most sophisticated new age hubs of wrong-headed thinking when it comes to the new science and the web of life. Another writer rather alarmingly reports that in new age nerve centers like Mill Valley, there's no shortage of nice guys, but it is rare to find an individual who can truly impress you with their integrity. So I trust that by the end of this talk, I won't be apologizing for my take on contemporary culture, but certainly one of the topics around town, in Mill Valley and beyond, is that of the impact of evolution on spirituality. When I hear talk that the Enlightenment paradigm is being replaced by the evolutionary paradigm, my ears perk up and I ask, well, what does this mean? The New York Times columnist David Brooks said in an article recently, while we postmoderns say we detest all explaining narratives, in fact a newish grand narrative has crept upon us willy-nilly and is now all around. Once the Bible shaped all conversation, then Marx, then Freud, but today Darwin is everywhere. Darwin, as we know, published his theory of evolution in 1859, yet others that preceded him nevertheless still grasped the power and importance of the concept of development and change over time. Any philosophy of creation or becoming, such as those put forward by Plato and Plotinus, for example, involved ideas of the progression from the one to the many, what is called involution, and the inverse or return from the many to the one, or what we call evolution. The matter of the becoming of the world and the troublesome relationship of a perfect transcendent reality that somehow manifests in connection with a world of changeable and imperfect forms has challenged and consumed thinkers throughout history. In the Western philosophical tradition, German idealists such as Hegel and Schelling were evolutionary thinkers that predated Darwin. For Hegel, the truth of any era was not static, but followed a developmental or dialectical process of unfolding in the context of history. And Schelling was perhaps one of the first to view evolution as an open-ended, spontaneous, and creative process, while at the same time affirming the divine as both transcendent from the world and imminent in its unfolding through evolution. Teilhard de Chardin, a remarkable evolutionary thinker and one of the scientists on the team that discovered Peking Man, asserted that evolution follows a clear trajectory towards higher and higher levels of unity and organization. While not all scientists agree with conflating the idea of directionality or purpose with the theory of evolution, the idea that natural selection alone as the engine of evolution has come into question. Other theories of the mechanisms of evolution have emerged, for example, the principles of self-organization arising from complexity theory and chaos theory are found at both the genetic and the cultural level. And they give rise to the notion of hierarchical governance as a way to achieve higher forms of organization, from cells to tribes to planetary systems. The way complex systems coalesce and self-organize gives rise to novel new forms that transcend and are always more than the sum of their parts. And these principles are understood to apply generally to any complex system. Spontaneous order has been observed to emerge from any complex system, such as a human community, an organism, swarming behavior in nature, a traffic circle, or the development of a city. Reductionism alone is not sufficient to explain emergence. A fragmented view of the world does not adequately explain the emergent whole, nor can it make sense of meaning of the astonishing plenitude and creativity of life. What these theories suggest is that the directionality of evolution from lesser to more complex and inclusive structures is an inherent characteristic to evolutionary growth, a built-in blueprint containing the principles for emergence. The principle at play here has been called transcend and include. In other words, as structures develop from simpler to more complex, the simpler form is subsumed within the higher, newly emerging whole, in the same way that molecules transcend and include atoms, organisms transcend and include molecules, etc. It would not be entirely correct to call this the logic of emergence, since evolution does not follow logical progression as we might normally think of it, but I would offer that it is a kind of logos of emergence, an inherent order that spontaneously unfolds, according to the conditions and place of its appearance. This organic activity of self-generating and self-organizing is also called autopoiesis, a Greek word meaning self-creation, originally applied to biology to define the self-maintaining chemistry of living cells, but now extended to the fields of sociology, systems theory, and of consciousness itself. This perspective of evolution as a guiding force in the world is one that views all life forms, including human consciousness and human societies, as evolving according to the same internal structures that guide the evolution of all living beings. The evolution of consciousness is thus tied to the evolution of all forms in a unified and integrated way. Amongst Western cultural creatives, this is increasingly becoming a new paradigm, one that is seen as progressive and unconstrained by the worldviews of both the traditional and the modern mindsets, a new kind of thinking that finds its roots in the postmodern and now increasingly what is being called the integral worldview. The word integral is often used in the same way as evolutionary, both terms pointing to this emerging paradigm. The word integral started appearing around the beginning of the 20th century, used by Jean Gebser and Sri Aurobindo, and whose works were highly influential on Ken Wilber, the contemporary philosopher whose body of work is called Integral Theory, and who has attempted to map the domains of science, philosophy, psychology, cosmology, and religion into a unified model of knowledge. This exercise of correlation across multiple specialized domains requires one to be a generalist in order to discern and discover patterns of meaning. However, being a generalist is more than just being a pluralist. And in fact, the integrative cross-disciplinary activity of making space for multiple perspectives and points of view has itself been called a higher level of functioning that represents a new stage in the evolution of consciousness. And the development of this capacity to embrace all perspectives is seen as a significant evolutionary leap. Wilber argues that holding many perspectives is essential to developing a correct view and indeed is a hallmark of integral stage development. This emerging evolutionary perspective holds that consciousness is the internal subjective dimension of the cosmos, a real space where we experience the world and which is not separate from the ontological fabric of the universe, and that it evolves as physical forms do. Equally, we inhabit a collective field of consciousness, not just as an individual subjectivity, but also as a communal intersubjectivity, which is an actual place where worldviews form and develop. Others have also formulated concepts to account for the idea of intersubjectivity, such as Carl Jung's notion of the collective unconscious, described as the structures of the unconscious mind, shared and inherited by our species, and containing instincts and archetypes. Teilhard de Chardin proposed the idea of the noosphere, which he described as a thinking layer that surrounds the earth and acts as the sum total of humanity's interior life. This shared experiential dimension of intersubjectivity is also what we call culture. Human evolution also is seen as a progression of levels and stages that have both psychological and cultural dimensions. We start life as children and progress through a series of developmental stages that have been found to correlate closely with stages of cultural development. By cross-referencing many developmental models ranging from childhood development, values, religious beliefs, cultural worldviews, cosmology, and the like, integral thinkers have noticed structural similarities and patterns that have started to connect the dots in a more holistic way. Stages of cognitive development within a lifespan from infancy to adulthood are thus also mapped to stages of cultural development, which in turn are mapped to stages of consciousness. At the individual level, developmental psychologists such as Jean Piaget revolutionized the way we think about the way children developed. Until the work of Baldwin and Piaget, there was little understanding of the stages of cognitive development that a child undergoes as its consciousness emerges. The discovery that children go through a recognizable stage development process was a significant breakthrough in understanding the way in which cognition unfolds, showing that mind is not static, but follows a progression that can be described in evolutionary terms. Various researchers have labeled the stages slightly differently, but again typically follow the stage developmental model of simpler to more complex, as in Piaget's description of sensory motor, pre-operational, concrete operational, and formal operational stages. This progression is understood to describe not only a biological developmental process, but also the nature of knowledge and consciousness and how humans come to acquire it. At the cultural or collective level, there have been several contributors whose work has shown the developmental progress of culture, perhaps none more eloquent and influential than that of Jean Gebser. He demonstrated that human culture can be traced through four distinct phases or structures of consciousness, and positioned as he was between two world wars, he believed he was witnessing the birth of a fifth stage. So he demonstrated that human culture can be traced through four distinct phases or structures of consciousness. And positioned as he was between two world wars, he believed he was witnessing the birth of a fifth stage, that of a new kind of consciousness he called integral. This new consciousness he also referred to as a perspectival. I'm not even sure how you say that word. Since one of its primary attributes was that it was not limited to its own perspective, but was able to reintegrate all the perspectives that came before it and allow them to become, quote, present to our awareness in their respective degrees of consciousness, end quote. It should be noted that he, Jean Gebser, believed consciousness had an atemporal immaterial source called origin. And this origin contains in itself, in a form of latency, the structures of consciousness that unfold over time. The first consciousness structure Gebser identified is the archaic level. He suggested that the archaic is a zero-dimensional level and that man in this stage was indistinguishable from the world and the universe, living in a state of consciousness with no differentiation between self and other. In the next level, that of the magic, man is released from his identity with the whole, representing an egocentric level of development where identity is of self and everything is seen as meaningful only to one's own self. Here, the magic world is a real world, where consciousness is a point-like unity and where the point can stand, where the point or part can stand for the whole, as seen with the interfusing of a cave painting of a bison with the bison itself. The next stage, the mythic, marks the beginning of time and history, whereas the magical stage is prehistory. The mythic is characterized by polarity. Language and imagination flourish, and the oral tradition that emphasizes the word takes hold. This is a traditional worldview, or ethnocentric, where identity is with the tribe, and there is a new inner awareness of a larger, richer world of the soul. The fourth stage, the mental or rational, is the modernist stage that was truly birthed during the Enlightenment, though Gebser speculates that its earlier structures appeared around 1225 BCE. thinking or thought forms in the way we know of them today are the characteristic of this stage, in that there is an unambiguous I doing the thinking. Humans step out of nature and out of the circle of congruity with their world. This level is also called world-centric, where identity is with humanity at large. Now, for Gebser, the integral stage was just emerging in his time. It represented a new worldview, he believed, a new way of integrating in consciousness all the historical stages of development that preceded it. It also heralds a new relationship to space and time. Here, identity is seen as cosmocentric, where identity is with nature, the manifest world, and oneness. In the integral stage, origin becomes perceivable, the spiritual becomes concretized, and the uncreated light becomes manifest. With each degree of evolution, the perspective advances to include and transcend the degree before it, becoming increasingly expansive and capable of comprehending a wider and deeper perspective. As noted earlier, these same stages are applied equally to childhood development. Thus, stage development describes both the interior as individual structures and the exterior as worldviews that are applied to the culture. In an example of the kind of effort to identify similar internal and external structures, Wilbur draws on Piaget and Gebser to cross-reference the sensory motor level with the archaic, the pre-operational level of the infant with the magic, the concrete operational with the mythic, the formal operational with the rational. Now, Gebser's ideas were further expanded in the school of thinking known as spiral dynamics, which in order to account for the cultural developments that emerged in the 1960s, particularly by identifying the postmodern stage that was inserted between the rational modern and the integral, plus an additional holistic stage after the integral stage that is yet to emerge, arriving in a total of 8 stages. They are described as worldviews and value systems, and are said to inform the basic structures of psychology and sociology. The stages make up an ascending evolutionary spiral through which individuals and cultures will pass as they develop, psychologically, culturally, morally, and spiritually. These values, moreover, can be seen at play in our world today, and thus spiral dynamics emphasizes the practical importance of understanding how these structures exist as stable organizing systems for cultures around the world. There is some research to demonstrate that 3 worldviews are currently active, at least in the West, that of traditionalism, modernism, and postmodernism. They subsist side by side, and we can observe these dynamics in our world. As the author Carter Phipps Riley notes, think Billy Graham, Bill Gates, and Oprah. Or Opus Dei, IBM, and Greenpeace. These are very broad generalizations to be true, but they make a point and can be helpful tools to understand the cultural wars of conflicting worldviews that we see daily in the media. So we pass individually and collectively through these waves of development, which we are told should be thought of not as rigid levels, but more like flowing waves with much overlap and interweaving. There are significant generalizations that help us orient our understanding of the human experience. A person's values can be seen to align with the worldview that represents their center of gravity, so to speak, and there are healthy and unhealthy expressions of each one. Development brings new potentialities, but it can also bring new pathologies and excesses. Additionally, one needs to guard against inappropriate value judgments of one stage over another, which can lead to alarming conclusions about cultural or racial superiority. Interestingly enough, Gebser himself was not a fan of evolution, perhaps because of its Darwinian overtones of survival of the fittest. Instead, he described his structures of consciousness as mutations rather than evolutionary stages. And furthermore, he did not consider any structure of consciousness superior to any other. Now, no discussion of the field of integral theory can really be complete without a nod to Ken Wilber, one of the most influential contemporary philosophers. Probably one of the most influential contemporary philosophers you've never heard of. And that's because he's not taught in any academic institutions, but instead has become a real philosopher of the culture and very influential across the Western culture at least. He has attempted what essentially amounts to a theory of everything, an attempt, in his own words, quote, to create a vocabulary for a more constructive philosophy. Beyond pluralistic relativism is universal integralism. I'll read that again. Beyond pluralistic relativism is universal integralism. I sought an integral philosophy, one that would believably weave together the many pluralistic contexts of science, morals, aesthetics, Eastern as well as Western philosophy, and the world's great wisdom traditions. Not on the level of details, that is finitely impossible, but on the level of orienting generalizations, a way to suggest that the world really is one, undivided, whole, and related to itself in every way. End quote. He has drawn on the ideas and philosophies of many integral and evolutionary thinkers and painstakingly mapped hundreds of developmental and knowledge systems into a unified epistemology. According to him, every phenomenon, event, or idea can be mapped to an integral epistemological model that posits that all knowledge falls into one of four quadrants, each of which represents a perspective. We have the individual interior, or the I perspective, the collective interior, or the we perspective, the individual exterior, the it or exterior perspective, and the collective exterior, the its or the exterior systems perspective. As an example, we can say that I have an individual interior experience, such as my thoughts and feelings. I also have an interior collective perspective, such as the cultural beliefs and values that I share with others. And I have an exterior individual dimension, such as my brain, body, and physiology. And finally, I also have an exterior collective perspective, such as the economic, social, and political systems that I participate in. So according to Wilber, not only does this epistemology cover all possible kinds of knowledge, but also evolution happens within each of these four quadrants, or these four perspectives. As an example, as the human brain developed, corresponding developments can be mapped to the interior development of consciousness, as well as developments in cultural organization and values, and of course political, economic, and trading systems. It's less certain if one can say that any one of these quadrants leads the evolutionary thrust, but what does seem appropriate is to view this model as a web of connection, a matrix of interconnected structures, where an event in any one quadrant resonates, shifting the whole dynamic matrix. So Wilber's integral evolutionary model is perhaps one of the more comprehensive of this emerging perspective, this integral perspective. And it certainly seems to signal a paradigm shift in that embraces the unity and independence of all things, with the difference that it is not a transcendent unity of some of the more traditional perspectives, but a very real and all-encompassing integral unity of everything, accommodating the discoveries of modern sciences and humanities. As more and more people travel down this path of unity, the integral stage of evolution is set to start taking shape. The initial outlines of the structures of the stage are at first thread-like, with the barest of shapes. As the paths are more traveled, they start to become better formed and more evident, within the culture, like a rutted road that starts out smooth and featureless, but over time becomes more recognizable as a well-traveled path or roadway. Wilbur says this does not preclude the great early pioneers and realized beings of earlier historical periods from exploring and realizing these higher potentials, but that these integral evolutionary structures are as yet lightly formed. Wilbur refers to our current time as the frothy, chaotic, wildly creative, leading edge of consciousness unfolding, and evolution, still rough and ready in its newly settling contours, still far from settled habit. Fully realizing the potential of the era depends on more humans traveling on the path until it becomes established as a real structure. This highlights an important point, that what we do individually and collectively truly matters. We are no longer seen as individuals residing in a static, pre-created universe. Instead, we are actually participants contributing to the process of evolution. Not only are we created beings, but also co-creators. Thus, there is a moral dimension to this newly emerging consciousness, what Wilbur calls an evolutionary imperative, that as humanity awakens to the new dimensions of the truths of our internal and external universe, thus we are inescapably tied to the era as the inner world of psyche and consciousness develops and transforms in concert with the larger world of cultural influences and shared worldviews. While arguing for a postmodern reinterpretation of wisdom spirituality, Wilbur nevertheless holds that key principles of the non-dual wisdom traditions hold true. Before evolution can occur, involution, or the emanation of spirit, must occur. The higher levels appear to emerge out of the lower during evolution, i.e. order appears to emerge out of chaos, life appears to emerge out of base matter, because they were already deposited there by involution. The higher order has to be already there in potential for it to emerge. Now, Michael Murphy, the iconic founder of the Esalen Institute in California, and an astute contemporary observer and commentator on cultural trends, suggests that these ideas constitute a new worldview, a fresh way of looking at the current human condition and the trajectory of our potential growth into the future. With the advent of the theory of evolution, he contends that many philosophers began to reframe their most fundamental questions regarding the relationship of our evolving world to God, to the role of humankind in the advance of the world, and whether human nature itself could evolve, and if so, to what end. Murphy points to the German idealists such as Fichte and Schelling, who posited that the divinity, while remaining transcendent to its creation, emanated or projected itself into the world, and that the process of evolution is itself the process or manner for the unfolding of the hidden divinity. Evolution follows involution. Involution as the descent of the divine into the world from transcendence, through the layers of existence to the world of matter, and evolution as the meandering yet seemingly inexorable emergence of new forms of existence from base matter to our current human species, and into the future to the forms yet to be evolved. This idea he has called evolutionary panentheism. We note that panentheism is the doctrine that the divine is both immanent and transcendent to the universe, unlike pantheism, which states that nature is identical with God. So Murphy thinks that one reason why the idea of evolutionary panentheism has attracted many people from different backgrounds and temperaments is that it is based on just two fundamental principles. First, the fact of evolution, and second, that the universe arises from a transcendent principle, be it called God, Allah, Brahman, Tao, or whatever name is given to it. Given the wide range of expressions that many contemporary writers and thinkers have given to this movement, Murphy suggests that it may be more accurate to call evolutionary panentheism an emergent worldview or vision rather than a philosophy. With the wide range of spiritually transformative practices that have entered the cultural mainstream in the last 50 years or so, and their propensity to challenge and stretch the boundaries of limiting beliefs and dogmas, Murphy believes that this shift in consciousness calls for a worldview or conceptual framework to connect the diversity and complexity that this expansion reveals. Spiritual practices from every great world tradition have become readily available, and along with the findings of depth psychology and transpersonal psychology and the science of consciousness and neurophysiology have all become part of the fabric of an emerging culture that more readily embraces a dramatic vision of the future potential of a world and of humankind that is entirely unprecedented. So this short summary so far of these some of these ideas reveals some powerful tools for understanding where we've been, where we are now, and how we got here. The great questions of life are being reframed, including the particular significance of the emergence of humankind. Now, not everyone is comfortable placing humankind at the center of evolutionary theory, not wanting to privilege an anthropocentric perspective in a process that, while purposeful in its emergence, in the minds of some may or may not assume a directionality or orchestration of evolution towards an emergence of humankind. In the area of deep ecology, for example, human beings are seen as the scourge of the planet, which would be far better off without them. Equally, many evolutionary thinkers feel the same way about the idea of God. What need is there for a traditional notion of a creator God in an evolutionary context? Or indeed, can one simply say, as some neo-atheists do, that since science has now displaced religion, we can dispense with ideas of transcendence, since surely consciousness simply evolves or emerges from matter as an attribute of mind, without needing to ascribe any divine purpose or teleology to its emergence? Well, at some point in our evolution, there was a huge leap forward in consciousness, and the interior universe of the self-reflective human mind was born. The step forward has been likened to the third Big Bang, the first being the birth of the cosmos, and the second being the explosion of life on our planet billions of years ago. The emergence of human autonomy and agency became the hallmarks of this biological life form called man. And increasingly, this emergence transitioned from being the consequence of an evolutionary process determined by natural selection and adaptation to a process involving conscious agency, an ability to stand apart from instinct and with freedom of choice. Carter Phipps argues that our problem is not that we are anthropocentric, but that our anthropocentricism is insufficient and impoverished. We do not yet fully understand our position, the dynamics of our emergence, or the responsibility of our power. We stand at the threshold where conscious evolution is a must. He and others believe we can no longer rely on the blind forces of history to take us through this next stage of our evolution, otherwise there may be no evolution at all. What does seem clear is that the explosion of information and knowledge in our times is indeed challenging our traditional concepts of God and the biblical narrative of the privileged place of man as the image of God. On the other hand, some great evolutionary thinkers such as Sri Aurobindo and Teilhard de Chardin have not shied away from affirming the tremendous importance of the place of human agency and consciousness in the created order. Sri Aurobindo spoke of the capacity of a higher mind intuitively grasping the whole as a unification of multiple ideas and not something established by logic. His system of integral yoga was an attempt to embrace an evolutionary paradigm within the yogic path. As he saw it, all created things are prefigured in a higher degree of existence before their appearance. And by process of involution, the original omnipresent reality, in its desire to create a universe of forms, extends itself to the degrees of mind, which provides the energy for creation. Conversely, the process of evolution, he described as the movement of that energy as it coagulates into progressively complex forms and ultimately into the human form. As the spirit pushes from above to manifest the new form of creation, so does it simultaneously push from behind the veil of evolution to meet up in the gnosis known as supermind. This is his term. What he calls for is no less than a conscious transformation on a global scale, a conscious act of spiritual midwifery, to birth a new era and a new species of humanity. Something that can take place by comparatively swift conscious change. And his vision extended beyond just the transformation of the individual to include social evolution and the future transformation of human society into a life divine in which humans may find meaning and purpose. Another great humanist, Teilhard de Chardin, saw a noosphere coalescing on Earth that will progressively unify the human race and converge to an omega point through which the spirit of Christ will emerge with ineffable splendor. This noosphere is likened to a new thinking layer, much like the geological layers that have been identified over the eons, and has spread over and above the world of plants and animals. In other words, over and above the biosphere, the living sphere, there is the noosphere. In his understanding, the world develops a new skin. This omega point towards which humanity is progressing is already in existence and at the very core of the thinking mass. For de Chardin, the only universe containing the human person is an irreversibly personalizing universe. And thus he places human consciousness at the center of evolution. Man, quote, man discovers that he is nothing else than evolution become conscious of itself. Man is not the center of the universe as we once thought, but even more wonderful, pointing the way to the final unification of life in the world. Interestingly, he does not predict indefinite progress, instead seeing the omega point as an eschatological endpoint for humanity, an ecstatic end of the world in which humanity finds its completion and oneness with the omega point or with God. So up until now, I've attempted to review some of the key ideas of the emergence of consciousness, the structures of consciousness, and the idea that we are somehow on the threshold of a new integral era. This potential for a future that many have glimpsed, hinted at, and hypothesized as a new consciousness, a new emergence of humankind, is where I believe Ibn Arabi can offer a contribution. The trajectory of Western philosophy, theology, and science that has contributed to these discussions has largely bypassed Islamic thought and key contributors such as Ibn Arabi, an omission that is slowly being addressed as his work becomes increasingly available in translation. While it might seem like a bold and somewhat asynchronous pivot to leap back in time from the 21st to the 13th century, it is precisely Ibn Arabi's own integral philosophy and very deep humanism that places him as one of the preeminent thinkers in this field. The ideas we've discussed so far find distinct echoes in his notion of the complete human or the perfect human, which represents a continuation and perhaps summation of the idea of the Logos that appeared in Western thought from the pre-Socratics through the Neoplatonists and, of course, in Christianity with Christ as the embodiment of the Word. In Ibn Arabi, we find perhaps one of the most comprehensive formulations of this idea. Logos has been described as a rational principle, an underlying order or structure embedded in the very nature of all things. In one of its aspects, it faces the sheer, undivided oneness of being, the supreme identity, beyond any attribution. And in another of its aspects, it faces the potential multiplicity of all possible things in their state of latency. The complete human thus stands as a bridge or connecting isthmus, serving to both unify and separate the two faces of reality, transcendence and immanence, which are understood to be complementary aspects of oneness. Now, the diversity of things, or possible existence, as Ibn Arabi calls them, enter the world not through a single creative act at a moment in history, but through an act of self-creation. And they appear in time according to an inner necessity particular to their original nature. So we can say that the principles for each thing's manifestation and evolution over time are part of an inherent underlying order that may appear chaotic, opaque, or mysterious, but nevertheless follow a directional unfoldment, an act of finding and discovery that causes the world to appear according to each potential thing's inner blueprint. Ibn Arabi does not admit creation ex nihilo, or of creationism per se, or even intelligent design. There is neither determinism nor true chaos in the divine order, but a creation that appears according to a logos. According to the well-known expression where God is doing the speaking, I was a hidden treasure and I loved to be known, the impulse for creation is attributed to love, and the manner of its unfolding is according to the hidden treasure, which self-manifests according to its original nature. This begins to capture the flavor of Ibn Arabi's non-duality, which he continually reminds us is an essential oneness of being. In Hinduism, we have the expression Sat-Chit-Ananda, which translated means being, knowledge, bliss. The word in Arabic most commonly used to describe this oneness of being is wujud, which in its root variants contains the notion of finding, which we can also express in the formula being, consciousness, ecstasy, wujud, wujdan, wajd. This is an idea from S.H. Nasser. This idea is key, since for Ibn Arabi, the idea of consciousness is never separated from being, and as the one differentiates itself into the many, consciousness and indeed ecstasy are inherent to the process of beings uncovering and discovering their individuated reality as they emerge in evolution. These three attributes of being, awareness, bliss give rise to all of the existential qualities that cause the world to coagulate out of nothingness. Now, at some point in history, the man we all know as Adam emerges. Who is this Adam? Is he a mythical biblical figure created in God's image, or an outcome of a biological process of evolution? I believe we can say he is both of these. From a certain point of view, neither statement has to be mutually exclusive. In the evolution of man, Adam can be understood to be the first human being whose interior structure has evolved to become fully capable of a new kind of consciousness, an integrated and harmoniously formed whole. Adam is thus a prototype for the complete man, possessing a new architecture of being that has evolved over many millions of years, and in which the Logos now fully consciously is realized. Adam receives the totality of the divine names because his constitution has evolved to become capable of it. Ibn Arabi's view of the unfolding of consciousness in history constitutes a kind of prophetology. The appearance of the divine wisdom and guidance to humanity is fulfilled through the appearance of the prophets. Adam is named a prophet, the first among many. Prophets are seen as conveyors of the word and the agency by which new degrees of knowledge are disclosed in the world. If the Logos is the primordial word, then the prophets are individual words and are like chapters of a book written over the course of history. This chaptering of the Logos in time covers a period of several thousand years from Adam to Muhammad, including 27 prophets, each of whom embodies and reveals a specific wisdom. In Adam, we see the emergence of a synthetic and integral nature capable of receiving all the divine names, a complete image of the divine for the first time. Abraham is the first man to be clothed with the affirmatory divine attributes. Jethro, the quintessence of heart wisdom, which unifies spirit, soul, and body. Solomon, the embodiment of compassion. And so on, including Moses and Jesus, and ending with Muhammad, who is seen as the pinnacle of this particular cycle of human emergence, and who becomes the total embodiment of a complete human being and the full realization of this Adamic prototype. What I would venture to suggest is that Ibn Arabi's teaching of this gradual disclosure of knowledge over time implies a proto-evolutionary way of thinking about human emergence, such that when a new wisdom enters the evolutionary stream by way of this human agency called prophethood, a new perspective or consciousness becomes established, and it becomes a part of the collective consciousness, building the structures that over time become a platform for the evolution of the human collectivity. Overlaying an evolutionary framework on top of Ibn Arabi's thought is not an attempt at reductionism of the great teacher's work, but an effort to correlate his ideas on emergence, consciousness, and man with this growing body of work, and to suggest ways in which his tremendous accomplishments might contribute to the new vernacular arising from this discourse. There is further evidence to suggest that Ibn Arabi was fully aware of evolutionary implications in the development of mankind. In another one of his works, he outlines a fascinating description of how knowledge or consciousness develops over time, and tells of a future time when many more people will share in an abundance of enlightenment, with more frequent and more complete realizations. In the past, he says, at the time of his writing in the 13th century, those closer to the Prophet, Muhammad, were characterized more by their practice due to their historical proximity to the Prophet's person. While the further away from that historical time we get, people become characterized less by practice and more by knowledge and direct opening. He says that fewer people in those earlier times had this knowledge, and they were less likely to manifest it because they dominated it. But over time, more and more people come to bear this knowledge, and whoever does manifests it because the knowledge dominates them due to its abundance. Ibn Arabi seems to be suggesting that consciousness itself is a constant, like water, flowing into containers according to the capacity to receive it, and that over time, the manner in which this consciousness or knowledge is manifested will change according to the number of containers that receive it. In this description, I believe, is an implicit acknowledgement of an evolution of consciousness over time, with increasing numbers of people participating in its plenitude, as the structure and shape of the approaching era becomes more discernible and tangible. So the necessity to make generalizations can lead to incorrect conclusions and misguided thinking. And the field of integral philosophy has itself been the subject of many critiques. At the level of details, it's clear much remains to be done and much remains contentious within the field itself. But the main thrust of this emerging philosophy, and indeed the intent of this paper, is an attempt to outline the generalizing orientations that help make meaning out of the complexity of so many disciplines and knowledge systems that this body of knowledge draws on. To return to the original question posed in this paper, is consciousness evolving? Well, like so many tantalizing questions, simple answers do not come easy. In one sense, the answer is no. Consciousness itself cannot be said to be evolving or changing if it is considered as the non-dual ground of all reality, or the space in which phenomena arise, or the emptiness and openness for all things to appear in. At the interior level of the self-identification of the one being, according to Ibn Arabi, consciousness is singular, transcendent, and uncreated, and not subject to change or evolution. However, in another sense, we can say that yes, consciousness does evolve over time, in concert with human evolution. from the perspective of the world, it is clear that consciousness has evolved from our origins in the Big Bang to the present day. It has been suggested that the evolution of human consciousness consists of a development of perspectives, and that each new wave of consciousness, each worldview that emerges over time, is a fundamentally new way of viewing the world and reality, and that it proceeds to ever-increasing levels of complexity, wholeness, and inclusion. The evolutionary movement questions the need for traditional origins, such as the Creator God, to explain the emergence of our universe. There is also an implied criticism of the perennialist stance, which, though honoring the unity of the great wisdom traditions, has not always found a way to integrate newer forms of knowledge into the older. The cosmos is in any case unfolding according to evolution, and if there is a divine impulse in creation, it can be seen emerging in the process of creation and according to the self-organizing principles embedded therein, and thereby exposing the seed or logos that is its origin. Not everyone agrees that this emergence follows a human-centric script, such as that outlined by de Chardin or Aurobindo, and instead may offer a more open-ended, endlessly creative and bountiful process of unfolding, where new forms emerge from the combination of the unformed novelty of the moment and the accumulated history of moments that preceded it. But it seems clear to me, at least, that these contemporary formulations, such as evolutionary panentheism and integral theory, expose what can be called a growing acceptance of a logos of emergence, an unfolding and concretization and detailing of an embedded and previously unseen order that is the reality of all things and its blueprint for emergence. We are all challenged in this era to integrate new forms of knowledge with the older, and to constantly question and validate our belief systems. Ibn Arabi declared that any concept of God we can imagine is a God that we ourselves create according to our own beliefs. He declared that the people of unveiling have been given an all-inclusive overview of all religions, creeds, sects, and doctrines concerning God. End quote. Thus, the cognizant person avoids limitation and accommodates in their inner structure all beliefs, indeed embracing the aperspectival view mentioned earlier that is capable of integrating all perspectives and beliefs. This, we are told, is the potential of the integral human, the complete human, and increasingly, it seems, the potential for all humankind. Thank you.